Welcome to Innovation on Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and we're broadcasting from the 4850-foot level from the Sanford Underground Research Facility in Lead. And it is that time of year for the annual Neutrino Day festivities. And to give you a bit of a preview, that's what we're going to do on the show today. First up is Jason Cruzan. He's the director of the Advanced Exploration Systems with NASA. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me today.
So talk a little bit about advanced exploration systems and what that means in outer space.
Yeah, so what that means is the group that I run at NASA is the technology group for human spaceflight. So all the different systems we need to keep people healthy and alive from here into deep space and onward to Mars. How do we build all that and actually create those technologies that we need to do it?
So this is the Journey to Mars project.
Yeah, so NASA talks about this overall. We're on a journey to Mars.
Okay.
And for human spaceflight, for scientific exploration, all those coming together to actually understand Mars to help understand ourselves.
And so all of the systems that you're developing are to make it self-sustaining?
Yeah, so one of the things we talk about in NASA's history is every time we fly like an Apollo mission and everything else, at the end of the mission, we threw everything away. So, and that's okay if you're just going for short sorties, short missions out to the moon and back. But as you go further, short.
Short mission.
Just to the moon and back. But if you're going all the way to Mars, you don't have a logistics change. When you go to the moon, you're 3 to 9 days at worst case from coming home. You go to Mars, we talk about there's no abort scenario. So when you go to Mars as human on a human mission, when you go and you depart Earth, you're not coming home until you've gone to Mars. Your abort situations for Mars is to the surface of Mars or to just loop around Mars and come home. So you are going to be gone for over a year regardless of what you want. So you need to be more sustainable, more reliable. All those types of things that you need to have that you can't rely on a supply chain for.
Okay, so give me some innovative things that you're working on.
Yeah, so if you look at where we're at today with humans on the International Space Station, we've been permanently crewed over 15 years. There was a launch just yesterday that probably people didn't even notice. We had another 3 crew members going up. But that's teaching us how to build habitats that last along, the homes in space. The space station modules and all that will be over 20 to 30 years in use by the time the station comes to an end. So we know how to build these long-term spacecraft that we need. So we're helping advance that. We're increasing the reliability of that. The space station, though, has a big, complex supply chain. We launch a lot of cargo up there. In fact, 15% of the global launch business is basically cargo to the space station. We can't do that to Mars. You can't forget something along the way and have them launch it ahead and say, oh, I'm going to catch up with you and catch up with the cargo later. So we're advancing the reliability of all the life support systems. We're figuring out new ways to do food storage for long duration, exercise equipment, all those kinds of things today on the space station that will then apply for our deep space mission to Mars.
And then how do you get it all to Mars in a timely manner?
Yeah, so once you have the place you live, then you need the engines to go. And it's what we call in-space propulsion. So we're looking at different ways to do that than we've done in the past. Everything we've ever done in the past is chemical rocket engines. There's now been advancements in technology for electric propulsion. So using high-energy physics, ions and Hall thrusters and even plasma engines to send cargo out on that long trip. It does take longer because the way the energy is released, it's released over a long period of time. To give you an example, if you were to, when we were launching the space shuttle, the 3 main engines of the space shuttle are the equivalent of 5 thrusters, electric propulsion thrusters, at 10% of the mass, so 10% of the weight. So we get a 90% weight savings, but then instead of the launch occurring in 5 to 8 minutes getting to space, it's going to burn for 10,000 hours on the trip outbound and back to Mars. But you get a lot of weight savings on that kind of propulsion system. So we're developing those new solar electric propulsion systems for that, even new thrusters for that. And then even beyond that, we are re-looking at nuclear propulsion systems for in space. Some of the technology that was invented in the 60s and such on using nuclear thermal propulsion, where you're using a nuclear element there to superheat the hydrogen and then send you out and back to Mars.
So what currently is on Mars? We have rovers.
Yeah.
Right
so
now.
I mean, the most active one you hear about today is Curiosity. It's the one. It's the very large car kind of roving around the surface, doing all kinds of great science. That's where all the imagery that you see coming back today. Included on that is an instrument that my group built called RAD. It's a radiation detector built by the Southwest Research Institute, and it's measuring the radiation environment on the surface of Mars. So before we send people there, we want to understand the environment we're going to put them in. That instrument actually was on all the way to Mars and is still on while it's on the surface, so we can actually understand the entire energy, the entire radiation environment on the outbound trip to Mars, and then on the surface to Mars, and then how do we design the habitats to then shield against that extreme radiation environment.
And what are you learning?
So it's interesting. The trip, if you would have been a human on board Curiosity's trip out there, you would have exposed, obviously, to the deep space radiation environment. But it wasn't as high as you would think. So we think about what is your cancer long-term life risk to cancer. Mm-hmm. And OSHA standards have a standard of about 3% lifetime risk increase due to exposure. This kind of trip would have been about 5% increase. So not a very large jump from what is considered normal kind of standards that we have today. The other part is we're understanding the shielding effects that the Mars atmosphere provides. So as you have seasonal differences, wintertime and summertime equivalents, your atmosphere changes density, which then changes the shielding type, and you see different energy levels on the surface. So we're understanding those kind of shielding effects that the natural environment of Mars provides for us.
And if, the humans who will go to Mars will be protected, correct, from all of this?
Yeah, so they'll be protected from some things. So there's a couple different energy sources, and this is why the facility here is important too. We have solar particle events. Things like those, they're relatively low energies. We can shield with them by putting additional metal in the spacecraft or plastics or even water bags and have protected areas of the spacecraft. Whenever we see a peak in solar particle events, we can have the crew shelter and they can protect themselves from that. The other energy sources are the galactic cosmic rays, GCR, that we see. The energy levels of those, there isn't anything we can do about. The best mitigation you have for those is to not be in the environment as long as you want to shorten the time that your travel time to Mars, or get into the even Mars's weak atmosphere, get into the atmosphere of Mars to have some shielding of that. But we look at both of those kind of as contributions, and we're how to lay out the habitats and then how to protect from those energy particles hitting the humans.
And so what you're learning by deep space science, how does that compare to what we're learning here in underground science?
Yeah, it's intriguing to me because they have to go deep underground to shield out GCR and the same kind of things in order to get their high science, their measurements they have down here. And you have to go deep underground, 4,850 feet, and get those measurements. Unfortunately, for us to shield, so we're shielding from that same thing in space, but we don't have the Earth's magnetic field or atmosphere to help as well. Here to conduct the measurements they're doing here, they have the magnetic field, the atmosphere, and nearly a mile of material above you, or water equivalent above you, to down then be able to shield all those effects to be able to do their measurement on the specific particles that they're looking at here. In space, we have to do all that shielding without the benefit of the magnetic field, the atmosphere, and carrying a mile worth of rock. So you can understand why we can't do it. Which is, so then then we trade into how do we get there faster? And what are the mitigation factors for that? Or hopefully in the long-term effects, we'll actually understand cancer-induced risk related to radiation exposure. And as people make more progress on mitigation strategies for cancer, we'll actually benefit from the biological advancements that the health industry is making as well.
And then would we see better shielding perhaps in X-rays and those kinds of testing, or no?
No, not so much for us, some of the shielding techniques we have, there's only so many things you can do when you talk about energy levels that are at this level. We can definitely mitigate the solar particle event type. Those are the most kind of catastrophic failures that you could have. if you look back at the Apollo missions and people have plotted when radiation events occurred from solar activity, there were significant events that could have been really bad for crews during the Apollo. They just didn't happen at the wrong time. So, yeah.
So you are also the keynote speaker here for Neutrino Day. Give us a little tease as to what you're going to talk about.
Yeah, so what I'm going to talk about tonight is we have a partnership with Fusion Media, MIT, and NASA. And what Fusion is creating is a virtual reality experience of what will life on Mars be in the 2030s. When you get to the surface, what will it look like? How will you drive around? How do you interact? What will it look like? I mean, what is that immersive kind of experience? So we've been working with them on creating really high fidelity virtual reality visualizations and even physics models of what that experience is like. So we're going to talk about that whole process of how did they make that as scientifically real as possible. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to flip it over and give you a little bit of a status on how all the things you're seeing in those imagery, how are we actually building and what's the progress on the real hardware to make that virtual reality reality.
And how is the progress?
Yeah, so there's major elements under development. We have a very large rocket, the Space Launch System, under development. We have a crew capsule called Orion. We're actually in studying right now the habitats and actually have concept studies underway. And in fact, later this summer, we'll announce our phase two contracts for actually studying the habitats, the actual habitat that we're sending out there. We have the thrusters. I was talking about those electric propulsion thrusters. We have those in testing now, the ones that we'll actually be able to use to send the crews out and back. So there's significant progress along the way. The first launch of the heavy lift launch vehicle will be in 2018. Two short years from now. It will have an Orion capsule on it. We will not have crew on the first one, but that first mission will go all the way out to what we call a distant retrograde orbit, which is a orbit around the moon and back, which will be further than we've ever sent a human spacecraft ever, including Apollo. It'll be a 21-day class mission out into deep space and come back, and it'll be kind of our shakedown cruise of that. Then in 2021, we'll launch the first version of SLS and Orion with crew on board.
With crew.
And then our goal is in the 2020s, we are actually going to build the habitat in deep space that will be the habitat we take to Mars. So we'll build it over a period of a decade, over a whole series of flights. And instead of building it in low Earth orbit, we're going to build it in orbit around the moon. And then the last phase of that is we actually attach an engine module, and that will allow us to actually do a shakedown cruise by the end of the 2020s. Early 2030s, that we'll actually do a year-long cruise mission into deep space with people on it to ensure that we have what we need to go out to Mars and come back. The key thing about all this is we're also not throwing any of that away. We're able to now build habitats that can last 20 or 30 years, engine systems that can be refueled and then reused and then brought back. So I like to tell people that we're actually now entering the phase of actually building the spaceships we all saw in sci-fi, which is, to me, the kind of the exciting phase that we're going into.
And so, did you grow up watching the sci-fi?
So, interesting enough, people had asked me, oh, did you always want to work at NASA? That was something actually I never thought about. I always thought NASA was for those special people, the really smart kids that would go do all the engineering. It was kind of this thing that wasn't for everybody. So I went down more of the engineering and technology route and management, all that kind of thing. Grew up in the computer era of actually democratizing of computers across the globe and all that, and really went into the building of the systems piece. And then it turns out that there was a home at NASA. So to me, I get really excited about building all the things that send the crews and colleagues out into space. That's what building things and flying into space is what makes me really excited.
So the ultimate goal, Jason, is to have humans on Mars in 2030?
So, yeah, I mean, in the 2030s, we want to first go in orbit around the Mars, maybe even stop off at one of the moons of Mars. Phobos is really interesting for that. And then onto the surface by the end of the 2030s or so. But more important, people talk about what's the destination of NASA. Is it to go back to the moon first, to go to an asteroid, to go to Mars? The fundamental thing that NASA is doing right now is building the capabilities that all of those are possible. So we build habitats, we build engine systems. They're not thrown away. If you want to go out to an asteroid in its native orbit on one trip, great, go do that. The next trip, the same piece of hardware, you fly new supplies, you resupply it. The next outbound trip, you go see Phobos. The next outbound trip, you go back to the Mars system, and you carry a lander with you. and you drop off the lander, you can go to the surface. So we're building these kind of capabilities that as technology advances, as scientific knowledge advances, we open up all those destinations. So I always talk about we're going longer and further in space than we ever wanted to go. I mean, that's just stay there longer, be more sustainable, how to learn, eventually learn to live off the land, harvest materials, water, oxygen, those kind of things along the way to allow us to permanently live off the planet eventually.
Now, how do we take what you're learning and what you're developing in space and bring it back home and apply it here on Earth?
Yeah, so some of these things like sustainability, like learning to live off the land. So on board the space station today, we recycle 85% of all of our water. That's an enormous amount of recycling, obviously. And we're actually increasing that right now to get up to about 93% closed loop on our water. So imagine if we were closed loop on water here on the ground. To give you a perspective, every ounce of water you drink here on average in the U.S., the same water comes back to you 600 plus years later. So a really, really long time scale. In space, you're drinking the same water every 6 days. Just don't think about that too much of where that water came from. So
humans need to help, right?
Yes. Okay. Human processing of a lot of that water. So every 6 days we're using the same water. We're in a closed ecosystem. At the same time, we're also monitoring and doing environmental monitoring. So we have really high precision instruments that allow us to do characterization of the air and the water that we have up there. We've been trying to make those instruments smaller and smaller. These are the same scientific instruments that we send to Mars to analyze what's in the Mars atmosphere. And eventually, does life exist somewhere else? So these instruments are getting really, really small. And I'll give you an example. We have what they call, it's a GC mass spec. It's a very highly analytical tool set that most labs, chemistry labs, have. And they do a full chemistry workup on something that looks like the old style, extremely large microwave ovens. And they cost $600,000 or something like that. We're now able to have that same kind of GC mass spec fit in a 1-inch by 1-inch by 4-inch long cube, a rectangle volume. It's literally printing some of this on a silicon chip. So can you imagine the ability to analyze all environmental characteristics of wherever you're at? It was something that could fit as an add-on to your cell phone. So these kind of advancements of technology, driving mass and power requirements and all those kind of things down, that Apollo did a lot of this with embedded circuitry. The benefits of miniaturizing all that equipment then has Earth-based applications for it. But I always struggle. People are like, oh, let's do a space program for the spin-offs of the things that's a hard thing to talk about, in my opinion, because we're also inspiring all the next generation of kids to go into scientific and engineering careers. Research labs like this are inspired by children, get inspired by children as well. We are answering some of those big, huge science questions that are out there that everybody wants to know about. And then the engineering challenges, all that kind of wrapped together. There's a very complicated benefits statement that people want to talk about with space. And people ask, like, what is the benefit of space? Well, what's the benefit to you? And it's a very individualistic kind of question for most folks.
Well, Jason, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on the program. You speak tonight at 6 o'clock at the Opera House in Lead. And tomorrow, you and I will spend some time together over the noon hour at Lotus Up for the Science Cafe, all part of Neutrino Day. So thank you, and I look forward to hearing you speak tonight.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
Thank you very much.